This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Is it just me, or has TV gotten really complicated? I'm either endlessly searching for my favorite shows or subscribing to a dozen different streaming services to make sure I can watch everything I love. And I'm not even saving that much money compared to my old cable bill. Thankfully, Philo has changed all that for me. One service, all the stuff I need. Philo's got current seasons of the shows I can't miss live on networks like Paramount, A&E, MTV, Discovery, and TLC. Classics like The Office, Martin, and Friends that I never get sick of, and all of the incredible originals on AMC Plus, from Mad Men to Orphan Black. Don't forget their library of more than 75,000 movies and shows, all of which I can save and re-watch anytime for a whole year. Never miss a minute of shows like Gypsy Rose, Life After Lockup on Lifetime, Yellowstone, or Fatal Attraction. Best of all, with Philo, you get all this for just $28 a month. No contracts, no hassles. Just one subscription and a world of entertainment. So go to philo.tv and check it out for a free 7-day trial. That's philo.tv to start watching.
Half a minute, no timeouts. Daniels throws down the sideline for Terry McLaurin. McLaurin is loose. Lightning strikes twice in Washington.
That was the second time this season, I think for all of us, that we just stood up and screamed out loud. We know when the first one happened. Can't believe that they didn't even touch Terry after that catch. He wasn't even touched. It's not like he broke tackles. 86 yards. And then, of course, roughly the 75th special teams disaster of the day. Good morning. Denton is here. You guys will have the chance to weigh in. Should they have gone for two? More on that and a lot of the second guess opportunities coming up in my game take. Look, these two have played some memorable games over the years, and so many when you least expect it games. Add this one to the list. 55 minutes of pure dreck, pure ugliness, 5 minutes of inexplicable, really. Bottom line is the team that you least expected it from yesterday won the game. And for Washington, it was a bad loss. Yeah, this one was a bad loss. 2 weeks ago, I described the Pittsburgh loss not as a bad loss, but a disappointing loss. In Philly, a week ago, Thursday night, it wasn't a bad loss. It was just a bad game that they had played in Philadelphia. But yesterday, as an 11-point favorite at home against a team that truly came in imploding, that's a bad loss. Despite the nature of this long-standing series, the nature of division games to start with, the history between these two teams, it's still a bad loss. Dallas was on life support coming into this game. They had lost five in a row, few of them, one of them of the five, an actual close game. I mean, we talked about last week, Denton and I did, that you could legitimately make the claim that Dallas was the worst team in the league coming into this game. Carolina had been playing better. It was either them or Jacksonville coming into the game. Add to that, they played on Monday night, had the short week. Washington had the mini bye after playing on Thursday Night Football the week before. I did call this a should-win game. I did call this a get-right game. And I don't think I would have described it any differently in where we were last week. Neither of those two ways of pitching and presenting the game last week was even close to being right. You know, this game turned out to be, you know, in the annals of Washington-Dallas, by the way, we're coming up this week on the 50-year anniversary of really one of the first, oh my God, what just happened games between the two of them. The Clint Longley Thanksgiving Day game, November 28th, 1974. This Thursday will be November 28th, 2024. 50 years. But over the years, I mean, the games, the way they've ended, the way you expected them to go before they started, but it didn't work out that way. This was unforgettable. These two teams combined for 38 points over the final five-plus minutes of the game. They scored 41 in the fourth quarter after nobody being able to score essentially for the first three quarters. The game included, among the special teams' plays, two missed PATs, two blocked kicks, a blocked kick field goal, and a blocked punt in the same game. Washington hadn't done that since 1977. You had two kickoff returns for touchdowns. The combination of two missed PATs, two blocked kicks, and two kickoff returns for touchdowns. By the way, with, you know, the two kickoff returns for touchdowns coming in the final 2.5 minutes of the game, it's the first time that's ever happened in an NFL game, the combination of those six things. I honestly cannot remember a game watching this team for all of these years that had this many impactful special teams plays in it, and so many of them being negative, although there were two positives. They blocked a punt and they blocked a field goal in the game, and the day was a disaster on special teams, which tells you just how bad they were everywhere else. But in this game, you know, you had a total of five missed kicks. Austin Seibert missed two PATs and missed a field goal. Brandon Aubrey had one blocked and missed a chip shot in the first half. It was a fiasco from a special team standpoint. I can't remember a game that had that many impactful special teams plays. But beyond that, the game really was, for the first 55 minutes, a top-shelf, hideous-looking game. Special teams fiasco, obviously. Turnovers, penalties, bad snaps, dropped passes. To me, though, the game really, for the most part, before the crazy final five-plus minutes of the game, for me throughout, I felt like the game was decided more than anywhere else at the line of scrimmage, as it often is in this particular sport. I felt like Dallas got the best of Washington in the trenches, both sides of the ball, but especially defensively against Washington's offensive line, and maybe even their play calling to a certain degree. I'll touch on that in the game take. I mean, Parsons was a problem. 97 was a problem. 58 was a problem. You know, you got to understand, this was not a good defense at all coming in to the game. They were the 31st ranked rush defense. Now, they got healthier, and they also did not have Trayvon Diggs for the game, but they've been getting healthier. And look, Mike Zimmer, we talked about this last week. I said the bigger issue going into this game is Dallas's defense, not Dallas's offense. We'll get to that part of it here in a moment. Dallas blitzed. They run blitzed. They loaded the box early. They just had a different ability, it appeared yesterday, than they had prior to yesterday, which, you know, certainly creates a lot of questions to be asked. Why did Washington struggle with a team that really couldn't stop anything coming in? You know, Brian Robinson Jr. got hurt on that first play from scrimmage. He got hip drop tackled. and wasn't right the rest of the game. Andrew Wiley was lost during the game. But none of that really should have added up to the way they got handled at times at the line of scrimmage. For what I would call the majority of the game, there were moments. There were certainly moments in the last 5 minutes. There were moments in a few drives here and there. And then on the other side of the ball, you know, the defense did have its moments, especially on third down, especially in short yardage situations on third down. But Dallas, you know, basically hurt themselves more than anything else in the first half in particular. You know, they had two missed field goals, a fumble, which was a defensive forced fumble. They had a snap, you know, that was bad, that ruined a drive. You know, they were a team, remember, we talked about this all week and especially on Friday. They were coming into this contest offensively essentially as a one-dimensional team. They could not run the football against anybody. Rico Dowdle had the second best rushing day of the season for him. This was a bad loss, you know, and there were chances to save it. You know, you could feel it coming, certainly when we got to the second half. You could feel it coming, and it was not a great feeling, but they had multiple chances to save it, you know, even before the miraculous 86-yard touchdown pass to Terry with 21 seconds left. They had the ball in the second half four times, either down by a point, 10-9, or down by 4 points, 13-9, and they kept self-destructing. A couple of drops, a fumble, and those chances were snuffed out. This is one of those games, man, that had a lot of, because of what happened really over the last 5 minutes, had a lot of those, you know, Monday morning quarterback perfect timing, opportunities, you know, the second guess from the couch. You know, why in God's name would you kick it to Kevontae Turpin at all? He was one of the best, if not the best, kickoff returners and punt returners coming in to the game. Why did you consistently kick it to him? Especially after he had already had, before the 99-yarder, he had already had a 38-yard kickoff return and a 30-yard kickoff return. The answer might be that Seibert isn't capable of kicking it into touchback land. Well, then maybe he shouldn't have been up yesterday. You know, another second guess from the couch opportunity. Why not go for two? Well, I'll get to that coming up in the game take. Why kick the field goal on second down with a minute 40 to go from 51 yards out? He made it. He made it. But after he had already missed a PAT and he had already missed a field goal at that point, that seemed a little dicey. Now, I understand what they were doing from a clock and a timeout perspective. But still, overall, just not a good day. You know, Pittsburgh and Philly, completely different conversations. Completely different. Yesterday was one of those NFL Sundays set up for a beatdown. One team plummeting, one team rested, one team not rested, one team at home, one team on the road. And Dallas won the game, 34-26. It's three straight losses now. They fall to 7-5. Tennessee's coming to town on Sunday. Tennessee beat Houston on the road yesterday. Denton and I have been talking about this game, you know, and more so we talked about it last week as a comparative to yesterday's game, saying, look, Dallas can't stop anybody. And they make up for it by not being able to move the ball against anybody. They truly stink. Didn't appear that way yesterday. Tennessee, however, is an excellent defensive team that actually can run the football a little bit. The quarterback is the problem. Washington was an 11-point favorite yesterday. The odds makers see Sunday much differently. Washington is currently just a 5.5-point favorite against a 3-8 football team. You know, it doesn't seem appropriate or the best of timing to be discussing playoff scenarios, okay? But they still hold down the last wild card spot in the NFC. But again, doesn't seem like the best time. They need to do something badly now. They need to win a game. They need to beat somebody, and they need to beat somebody soon. And really, at this point, it doesn't matter what it looks like. Because Sunday now becomes not must win, because they're certainly not mathematically eliminated with a loss. Far from it. But it does feel like it is a have-to-have game to stop the bleeding. I didn't view them as a bleeding football team after losing to two excellent football teams in Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia. Speaking of, how about how impressive they were last night? Saquon Barkley, 255 yards. My God. And that isn't even their best feature. Their best feature is their defense. It is so good right now. They are clearly now the massive favorite to win the division. They've got a three-game lead in the loss column. Now, they do play Pittsburgh, and they play Baltimore before they come here. But right now, Washington can't win a game. Pittsburgh and Philly, part of a season in which you're going to play some really good football teams. You're going to play some really good football teams at the wrong time. Yesterday, though, completely different. They need a win badly to get us back, at least headed in the direction of the conversations we were having just 2.5 weeks ago, because it seems to be slipping away. And it seems to be slipping away in a way in which we didn't think it was possible for it to slip away.
Low snap. It is no good. And the worst special teams day in history has a fitting finish.
Why is Sheehan throwing that in our face once again? Well, this from Paul to start the show. Sunday was on Dan Quinn. The kicker should have never been out there. They went with a hurt kicker over a healthy kicker. Major blank up. From Denny, Kevin, the head coach took an important game and made his kicker's psyche more important than winning the game. Follow this. Seibert was feeling threatened by his replacement, Zane G. That would be Gonzalez. Denny, he did not go for the 4th-and-2 in the first half when they've done it all year long, and instead thought Seibert could use a 50-yard field goal for his confidence. Then the 51-yarder at the end of the game on 2nd down. What? Seibert wasn't healthy enough to be out there, and the kickoffs were proof. You asked it, why would you kick the ball to Turpin in that situation? Quinn's answer was basically that he wasn't healthy enough to kick it into the end zone. Big mistake to have him out there instead of Zane G. Well, good morning, everybody. How we doing? You know, here's one thing that I believe to be true about Sunday's loss to the Cowboys. This one really hurt. This one stung. Like, it was the first one for me in a long time that left, you know, kind of a bad taste afterwards. Felt like, not despondent, no, but certainly felt like, damn, you got to get that one. It's been a while, you know? I mean, we haven't had a good enough team to legitimately feel that way, to feel the sting of a loss. You know, they were an 11-point favorite, the biggest favorite they've been since 2017. They were at home against a bad team on short rest, while our team had a mini-bye worth of rest. You know, the teams over the last 6 to 7 years here just weren't good enough to really feel that kind of, you know, hurt after a loss. Losing games was more of the expectation, even when, you know, you thought they had a decent chance to win. You know, Sunday was kind of the first time since 2016, maybe, that we felt we had a good enough team that we could expect to win. You know, the 2016 season finale against the Giants was real sting and hurt and pain. No other team, really, you know, since that team was good enough to expect to win. you know, or to even play in games that were meaningful enough to kind of feel the sting of an expected win that went wrong, like Sunday. You know, more of a thought than a lecture. You know, the first nine games, it's not that they were fantasy, but they were abnormal with a rookie quarterback, abnormal with a first-time coaching staff, and with a complete, almost complete, you know, a half to two-thirds roster changeover. You know, the truth is, and I, you know, this doesn't change the way we feel now because we're living in the moment. We're not living back, you know, Labor Day weekend. But anybody would have taken 7-5 at this point with right now playoff positioning, with a game against the Titans on Sunday where you're nearly a 6-point favorite. You know, up and down is the way it was supposed to go, and it just didn't. It was all up until recently, and now we've got our down. And really, I don't count losing to Pittsburgh by a point, having the lead in a poorly played game at Philadelphia in the fourth quarter and losing. I didn't consider either one of those games to be hurtful in that way, or even a sign that up and down was coming. Sunday was, for sure. Now back to the kicker, you know, thoughts from Paul and Denny. So, look, I don't think that Dan Quinn brought Austin Seibert up for the purpose of enhancing his psyche because he was feeling threatened by Zane Gonzalez, who had not missed, right? Zane Gonzalez hadn't missed, I don't think, that Denton in the couple of games that he had kicked. He had kicked well. He had also kicked, you know, several touchbacks while he was there. You know, the fourth and two, it was unusual, right, that they put the kicker out there instead of going for it, you know, especially against that team. You know, second drive, you've got a 3-0 lead, got a chance. They've been doing that a lot of the year, and they've been successful doing it. They've been one of the best fourth down teams in the league. I don't think he put Seibert out there because he's like, I want to build this guy's confidence. And it was a 51-yarder, by the way, not a 50-yarder. And obviously he did not, you know, was not successful on that kick. But it was kind of strange that they didn't go for the fourth and two there. And, you know, I've already talked about this, but the 51-yarder with a minute 40 to go on second down was, for me, a bit of a stretch considering the kicker issues at that point. No doubt. I agree with you. But I understood why they did it. From a clock and timeout standpoint, you pretty much had to get the three if you were going to have a chance without recovering an onside kick. You needed to get it with, you know, somewhere around a minute 40 left, which is what they did. But still, you know, they couldn't have felt great about him kicking a 51-yarder after he had already missed a 51-yarder and missed a PAT. I don't know that I don't agree with you that he activated him for the game on Sunday for the purpose of, you know, getting his psyche right because he was feeling threatened by Gonzalez. I don't agree with that at all. I do wonder whether or not there is some, you know, second guessing in that building as to whether or not Seibert was healthy enough to have up for that game and whether or not more consideration should have been given to the kickoff portion of the game on Sunday. They have been very good in kick coverage all year long. Let's make sure we understand that this has been a punt coverage and kickoff coverage unit that has been one of the better units in the league. You know, in kick coverage, kickoff coverage, and punt coverage. And we have seen all year long their intention of trying to get Seibert and even Gonzalez to knock that ball into that landing zone, into a spot in the landing zone that gives you a chance to get down and stop the returner before they get to the 30-yard line. You know, you bring into a lot of, you bring into the equation when you decide that you're going to cover a kick, more than just the opportunity to nail him before the 30, but, you know, how often do we see a penalty on returns? So you have an opportunity to really pin them deep. But, you know, Jaylen Warren had a good kickoff return against them. Shipley had a decent return against them. And this was the returner that they have on their schedule. So, yeah, I agree with you. If Seibert wasn't healthy enough to kick the ball deep into the end zone to make Turpin think about not bringing it out or out of the end zone, which, by the way, is the reason the rule's in place right now, the new rule, is because too many kicks were kicked out of the end zone for the last few years, like three quarters of them. You know, so if your guy wasn't, if he can't do it, we've seen him do it, by the way. We have seen Seibert kick the ball deep into the end zone and even out of the end zone. But if he wasn't healthy, and Quinn implied that it was a hard thing for them to do, he wasn't specific about why. You know, it could have been field conditions, it could have been wind, but I'm guessing what Denny guessed, which is the kicker wasn't healthy enough to do that. If that's the case, they made a mistake Sunday. You know, this isn't talking about it after the fact. We talked about it on Friday as one of the keys to the game, is that Turpin's the guy, along with Lamb, that can make plays in the game that can impact the game. So don't let them. And they let them. They let him. In a bad spot, too, where you don't want the clock to run on a return, for starters. So, yeah, if he wasn't 100% healthy, this was not the game to have him up, because kickoffs should have been more seriously thought of as a potential game changer. You can be confident all you want in your kickoff coverage team, which they had good reason to be heading into that game. But you had given up a couple of decent returns in your last two games. And he was a different animal than the other guys that were returning kicks. And yes, just to emphasize, because I talked about this yesterday, the kickoff was effective. It was a really good kickoff into the landing zone. Hit, bounced underneath the legs of Turpin, and, you know, it threw off the whole coverage piece. Look, to blame Reeves or to blame anybody else for that return is crazy. I mean, the guy made a spin move and then an accelerated move to where he outran everybody, which he can do. It was a ridiculously incredible, sick return by Turpin. You just would have liked to have seen them take the ball out of his hands. And if Seibert really wasn't capable on Sunday of kicking the ball deep into the end zone or out of the end zone, then he shouldn't have been up. Should have been Gonzalez. I do agree with that part. I disagree with, you know, he brought up Seibert to get his confidence back. By the way, if that was the reason, it didn't work, clearly. Feel badly for Seibert, but this is professional football. And he was a big, big part of why they lost a game that everybody expected them to win, but not the only part. I mean, the rest of the team didn't do their part either. You know, in a game in which you're an 11-point favorite, you know, throw out the point spread. We all understood Dallas sucked as a team. They were a bad football team coming in. Teams had absolutely been blowing them the blank out. And it shouldn't have come down to a kicker. And maybe that was part of Quinn's thinking going into the game. I'd hate it to be, because that's selling an opponent too short. But maybe he was thinking, look, this is the game we can bring him back. You know, there aren't going to be many big kicks, you know, and we'll be okay because we should dominate these guys. I mean, hopefully he's just kicking extra points all day. The fourth and two, and one of the callers called in. It's a really good point. Now, I went back. It's fourth and a long two. That's fine. But still, this was something that they, especially with the field position, you know, a 51-yarder at that point, you go for that. That is an analytics go-for. And by the way, a context go-for it as well. You know, because at that point, that was their second drive. Their opening drive, remember, started with the blocked field goal return. You had the speed option, which was a spectacular play. Just go back and watch that speed option play on 3rd and 12. It's outstanding. Really, I think a call to get him into better field goal range. But, you know, you've got as a runner on Sunday, a cheat code in which he takes it for 16, 17 yards. And, you know, your inability to really run the football with your running backs reared its ugly head early, right? With, you know, on the opening drive with Brian Robinson getting nailed in the backfield on the play he got hurt on for a 2-yard loss. And then Eckler got three and then no gain, you know, on runs. And then you're taking a shot to Ertz, which, you know, was incomplete. And they're, you know, talked to Cooley about that play on my podcast yesterday. And he felt like Ertz, he doesn't know how it's coached, but he said two things. Daniels needs to put more air under the ball, and Ertz shouldn't have leveled or flattened that route out in that spot. Anyway, yeah, still feeling it a bit. I hear you on that. Yesterday didn't feel, or Sunday didn't feel good. And it puts them into a very, you know, take all the previous seasons out of the equation. We're living in this season right now. They're 7-5, and they've been at times a pretty damn good team, certainly on offense. We got to see that come back. But somehow, some way, regardless of whether it's done offensively or defensively, they got to win Sunday. Because it is not free fall yet. It's not implosion yet. But four losses in a row with two straight at home against Dallas and Tennessee, you know, at that point, I think they would get written off by a lot of people. It may be too early because you'd still have four games left in the season to play. And you've got a bye week after Tennessee to kind of get things together, hopefully. But, man, you need this one. This one is a Jay Gruden Code Red special. His code red was because he was going to potentially lose his job if they didn't, you know, if they didn't beat the Buccaneers in 2015. But this one doesn't have anything to do with job security. It has to do with season security. They need to beat the Titans any way, shape, or form. Right now, I would much prefer the 35-17 offense puts up 420 yards, you know, punts twice in the entire game against a good defensive football team, and you go into the bye week feeling much better about things, chance to get healthy, chance to get Marshawn Lattimore into the lineup. I'm not saying that he's out for this week. I don't know if he's out for this week. We'll find out more tomorrow for sure. But at the same time, if it ended up being, you know, 13-10, and neither side of the ball played great, or, you know, I'd take that too. Got to get to 8-5. Have to get to 8-5 going into those final four games. Because, you know, that Saints game doesn't look like it did 3 or 4 weeks ago. You know, the Saints have won two games in a row. They beat, you know, the Falcons. They beat the Browns, understood. They have a game Sunday against the Rams at home. And then they play the Giants when Washington's on their bye week. It's not inconceivable that the Saints could work their way back into playoff contention. Like, if they were to beat the Rams and then beat the Giants, they'd be 6-7. That would then be a huge game against Washington for wild card positioning. Even if Washington beats Tennessee, be a massive game. So that one obviously doesn't look great. The Atlanta game could be a massive game for both teams when they get there. The Eagles game clearly is going to be a big game. Even if you get to that game and the Eagles still have a hefty division lead, the Eagles are going to be playing for seeding. They're chasing down Detroit right now. The Eagles are leaving Washington in the division a bit in the dust right now. You know, they're three games up in the loss column with a win head-to-head already. They do play Pittsburgh. They do play Baltimore coming up. But Philadelphia right now is playing as if they may be one of the top three, four teams in the league. So the division race, I'm not calling it at this point. No way. I'm just saying that you could get to that game and the Eagles could still have, you know, two game lead with a head-to-head advantage at that point. Well, we've got royalty on the show today. Steve Buckhantz joins us courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline. He is doing the Altcast tonight With, of course, Phil Chenier of the Wizards group play NBA in-season tournament thing, whatever that is, against the Bulls. So check it out on the Monumental Sports Altcast. I will be doing that because Buck and Phil together is iconic in this town. But that's not where I want to start with you. You texted me about Seibert on Sunday, about the snap and the kick on the PAT. First of all, will you share with everybody your kicker credentials in terms of why you can speak expertly on the kicking game?
They're pretty low on the profile, Kevin, but I was a kicker in high school over here in Arlington at Washington Lee High School, which is now called Washington Liberty. And I placed kicked and I punted. But back in the day, as you know, everybody was a straight-on kicker. There was no such thing as a soccer-style kicker. So it was the kind of the Mark Moseley approach, and then it evolved, obviously, into, you know, Jan Stenerud and all of those guys that kicked soccer style. So I did that. Those are my credentials, Kevin.
So tell everybody what you thought about Seibert's day, specifically about the final PAT.
Well, I think as I looked at the thing as a whole, it was a combination of a lot of things that caused that kick. But what fans need to understand is it's not just the kicker who makes the kicks. It's the snap, it's the holder, and obviously it's the protection. But in this case, you know, I don't – and listen, yes, you can get inside of a kicker's head. So if you miss a field goal and then you come back and you maybe miss an extra point, and keep in mind, extra points now are 33 yards. Back in the day, they were 10 yards, and then they became 20, and the, and the NFL just said, you know, hey, we need
to
make this
harder. Nobody remembers them being 10 yards. Yeah. Nobody, well, I saw, they're just a few people remember the goalpost being at
the goal line. And I remember Tom Dempsey, who kicked for the Eagles, who originally held the record 63 yards, missed an extra point because he kicked it off the side of that little club foot that he had, and he missed one from 10 yards, which is hard to believe, but it happened. But at any rate,
if you go back and you check out box scores pre-1973 or 74 or whatever, when the goalposts moved back to the end zone, you would see field goals of 8 and 9 yards. Because if you got to the 1 yard line, 7 yards back was an 8 yard field goal.
Exactly, exactly. So there were a lot of factors, I think, Kevin, that went into this thing. First of all, he's coming in off a layoff, obviously. He missed, the previous two games. So
he's hurt.
There's that to think about. But as a kicker, and I wrote, this is what I texted you, 70% of the time when there's a bad snap, whether it's high or low, and in this instance, I think Tress Way did a really good job to pull that thing up off the ground and set it up with the laces facing away. 70% of the time, the kicker is still going to make that kick. But maybe 30% of the time, it definitely affects the approach and the kick and the timing. Timing is huge for a place kicker, and these guys practice that, obviously. And when that snap was low like that, it can throw you off. Now, like I said, especially on an extra point, which is 33 yards, which is still, you know, you can miss that, which obviously happened. That snap and that hold needs to be really perfect, and they practice that all day long. And when it's not, it can affect you. It can get inside your head. Now, maybe his head was already a little messed up because he missed and he's coming off of a layoff. But what I find this interesting, Kevin, is that here's the guy that came in his first game and made 7-for-7 field goals. This is the same guy. So he's good, but, you know, and I think he's very good, but he had a bad day. And you can't put that kick all on him. The snap, first of all, was not good. So you got to put some of it on the snapper. The hold was really good by Way, but clearly it affected the timing. And that's what I think fans need to understand is it's not just, hey, let's get the ball down and the guy kicks it. When that snap is low like that, as the kicker makes his approach, he wants everything to be perfect. And when it's not, sometimes it can really affect the kick. And I think that's what happened in this case.
What was your longest field goal at Washington and Lee?
I think 46 yards. My longest punt was 66 yards. I got a tremendous roll. It went all the way down to the 1 yard line, and one of my guys downed it. But that was a lot of fun back then.
But still, a 46-yarder in 1958 is a long field goal. That's a long
Kevin,
kick.
I was three then. Thank you very much.
all right. You're back with Phil tonight on the Altcast for Wizards Bulls. How much do you miss calling the games on a night-in, night-out basis with Phil?
You know, this sounds a little like a cliche because I hear a lot of athletes say this and coaches and what have you, and even guys in our business. I miss the camaraderie, you know. I miss calling the games. The games are a lot of fun. I don't like the preparation. That's a lot. But the games are a blast to call. I've said this before. You could ask Kevin 100 sportscasters in our business what they really like to do, and 99 of them will tell you play-by-play. There's nothing better, and you've done some play-by-play. There's nothing better than that. And at this level, the NBA level, when you're standing on the court next to Michael Jordan or LeBron James or Kobe Bryant or whoever it happens to be, you got to pinch yourself. You know, I used to do it all the time. Sometimes I just stand there and go, I can't believe I'm here. And it was, you know, doing the play-by-play is a lot of fun, but it's really being with all of the people at the arena, the security people. Some of those people are my best friends, and the people in the organization, and of course the other broadcasters. It's a very small fraternity of broadcasters. You know, there's only 30 local TV play-by-play guys for, you know, in the NBA with each team, and we're all very good friends, and even the radio guys too. And there's those guys. So obviously Dave Johnson and Glenn Consor and those guys, and the guys that are doing the games now. You know, there's no competition between me and Phil and Chris Miller and Drew Gooden. Those guys are our closest friends. I mean, Chris obviously did sidelines with us for 12, 13 years, and I did a lot of games with Drew. So. And this Altcast is on the Monumental Sports Network, so we're all in this together. And I don't want to take anything away from Chris and Drew because I think they do a really good job. So for me, this is going to be a lot of fun because Phil and I, we talk all the time, we text all the time, we get together once a month and have dinner or whatever, and we reminisce, you know. And I think that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to tell some stories. You know, it's an Altcast. It's an alternative way to watch the game. Now, look, as a purist, Kevin, I would rather watch the game and listen to the play-by-play guys. But this is a different way of watching the game, just like the Manning cast. It's a way of exploring some other avenues about the game. We'll get into the game if it's close. We'll engage it and that thing. But I think tonight's going to be a lot about stories, you know, that Phil and I shared over the 20 years we did the games.
There's some that you won't be able to share.
Yes, there's some that we won't be able to share because, you know, they had an edict when we were back then, and just like the Las Vegas thing, and the edict was what happens on the team plane stays on the team plane. However, the statute of limitations is up on that, Kevin. So there are some things that I can talk about that I can tell.
Be careful because some may be coming back your way too. You know what I'd love to hear from Buck? Buck is the number one restaurant advisor, restaurant critic for any major city, certainly any NBA city in town. And you are that for our city as well. So you always enjoy food talk. I've got a question for you. We haven't talked about this.
Okay.
How much has Al Michaels lost his fastball?
You know, I think, he's one of the best play-by-play guys ever, my opinion. Ever.
I agree.
And, excuse me, and I think he's still strong. But you can, listen, you can tell when you listen to a broadcaster when they're starting to age, and it's all about age, really, because you hear them start to very slightly slur their words just a little bit. Now, look, this happened with Jack Buck. It happened with Pat Summerall. As we get older, you tend to, you know, slur just a little bit. Or maybe you don't react quite as quickly as you would have when you were absolutely on top of the game. And I think that's what we're seeing from him. Now, I listened intently the other night when he did the game, and I guess it was Thursday night, and
the snow game.
You know, I thought he was pretty much on it. But the other thing, too, Kevin, is that back in the day when this used to happen, maybe when it happened to Jack Buck or whomever it was, even Costas, there was no social media, so you didn't really didn't hone in on it. Now everybody and their brother is coming out and saying, "Oh, he's lost it. He should be done. You should quit. This, that, and the other thing." He should quit when he wants to quit because he deserves that. And maybe somebody will point it out to him, or maybe he'll see it. But I think he's still good enough to be doing the games, and he's good at it. But I understand what you're saying, and it happens.
Who's
it happens
your
as we get older.
Right now? Who's your favorite play-by-play? It can be any sport. Who's your absolute, he is the best there is right now?
Unequivocally, it's Ian Eagle.
How about his son?
His son's good, but, apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But right. Ian is the best at what he does. Not only is he so good at seeing everything that happens on the field, all the nuances, all the quirks, all the things. He obviously knows the rule. He knows how to call a game. He knows how to rise to the drama of a game. And obviously we're good friends because he calls the Nets. And he's a hysterically funny guy, really funny, and a great guy. So all those things go into it for me. But when I watch him and listen to him do a game, and we text during games all the time, I think he's really, really good. Now, look, Jim Nance is as good as you're going to get, too. I mean, he's fantastic. But those guys, in terms of network, TV, play-by-play guys, would be my favorites. And, back in the day, obviously, you had Summerall and Brookshire and all the guys that were at CBS that are long gone, but Ray Scott and Frank Lieber, and I'm going way back, but those guys are the best. And I just think Ian is on top of it. He's really good. And Marv Albert, obviously, was legendary as well.
Well, Breen, who you know pretty well, is excellent.
Mike Breen is great. I should have mentioned him at the top as well. And I know
Tirico's
him well.
And he's great.
Tirico's fantastic. There's a lot of really good guys. Gus Johnson, obviously, who was my intern at Channel 5. He's become very, very popular.
Yep.
Van Pelt, I don't think he does a whole lot of play-by-play. He does some, I guess, but he was another one that was my intern at Channel 5. So
yes, he was.
It's a small business, Kevin. Obviously, you and Scott are very close, and it's all you guys were with us at Channel 5. And it's a very small business. Chick is doing a great job with his play-by-play now with CBS Sports Network. And but Breen is great. And listen, there isn't a classier dude in this business than Mike Breen. He is, I'm telling you, some of these guys have it in their head and they get, really pretentious and all of that. He's the most unpretentious guy I've ever met for being as big as he is. He is just a fantastic guy and a great, great play-by-play guy.
All right. Have fun tonight.
We're not talking any planes, Kevin. You're disappointing me.
No, we'll do plane crashes next time. I'm out of time now because or they'll crash this one. But we haven't had any good ones to talk about in a while.
No, we don't have to talk about crashes. We can talk about other plane stuff.
Well, we can just do morbid plane crash talk the next time you're on. But we'll let everybody enjoy the holiday week. I'll talk to you later. Enjoy tonight.
I will. Looking forward to being with Phil and J.P. Finley on the Altcast. Thanks, Kevin.
It'll be awesome. All right. Steve Buckhantz, everybody.
After Terry's touchdown, you immediately make the signal for one. Did you give any thought to two?
No, I thought if after we score, we'd go for one. And the reason behind that, I thought, let's get back into it. But we don't have to decide it on this play. And so that was where I thought, let's go. And then, hey, Joe, we got one stop. We'll get it. And then at the coin toss, let's go through the whole process again and reset it. So I thought in that way, that was the right call. And that, as obviously, you're not factoring in the other part of things. But that was my thought going into it. Previous one, if we had scored, we had to kick a field goal. I wanted to kick the field goal in prior to the 2 minutes so we could use that, have the other timeout. So when you're down two scores, you're kind of a little more strategic to get a kick in prior to a certain time. So that's what we had told Jaden in the offense. Let's get it in before this time. And so it gave us a chance to come back to it, get the stop to go, and then the big one to Terry. So, but I was thinking one the whole time. Sorry, long-winded answer to your question.
Yeah, the time is basically around a minute 40 when they kick the field goal. You can't let it go down much further than that. Then you're talking about less time. I think actually it was debatable as to whether or not they should have onside kicked it afterwards. I think that they, with two timeouts left in a minute 40, they could have kicked it deep. Look, they ended up getting it back and scoring a touchdown anyway. And on the two-pointer, In the moment, I leaned, a slight lean towards going for two because I just felt like it's Jaden. He's on a roll, you know, certainly as a runner, and had gotten into a rhythm, certainly as a passer. But I was totally fine. It is not, you know, a slam dunk answer either way. And certainly you can make the case that having them reeling was a reason to go for it and at the same time a reason to kick. And I think the key piece of that is, yeah, the kicker was struggling, but he had made the 51-yarder, you know, in that spot, you know, with a minute 40 to go. I like, by the way, that they just have an awareness of those things. Yes, it was a bit, you know, a bit risky for a guy that had missed a PAT and missed a 51-yarder already to come out and kick a 51-yarder. But just the fact that they knew with two timeouts what the cutoff was to kind of get the three on the board at least gives you this sense that they have an understanding on how to manage that. I think it had to be a bit of a tough decision, though, because a 51-yarder for him in that spot, given what had happened on his two previous kicks, it was far from a given that he was going to make that. All right, 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980. Your chance. Let's get some calls in here. Joe in Springfield's been on hold for a while. Joe, appreciate it as always. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, Kevin, thanks. How you doing?
Good, Joe.
All right, so I'm going to give a quick like, and there's a lot I didn't like, and I got a side note with a bone to pick with you, Kevin, about something you said last week, but let me get to the quick like first. Bobby Wagner and Frankie Louisville, again, shine on defense. Every single week I put them in the like speak, and Bobby Wagner caused a key fumble yesterday. I mean, even though we didn't get any points about it. I mean, that may have led to a missed field goal that side, but I'm not sure, but still, it was a good field position. Quan Martin made a good block on the field goal on the Cowboys' first possession. What I didn't like, opportunities that we could have had that were wasted. How many? We blocked the field goal. Dallas misses a field goal in their next possession. We blocked the punt. Actually, that's when we got the field goal on the blocked punt. Then Dallas fumbles. We have great field position. We don't take advantage of that, and we only get 3 points out of that. I mean, that's awful. I mean, it's like that tells you right there that we were not may have been prepared for it. And the side note, Kevin, I mentioned this to you last week on your show, and you and I always are agreeing on the same page. But I did call on the show last week. I said, if in this rivalry, if Washington's doing well and Dallas is not doing well, Dallas wins, and vice versa. It happened yesterday. And now we got a Tennessee Titans team coming here on Sunday who is looking pretty good after beating Houston. And I understand that their record may not show it, but their defense is good. This is another dog battle, Kevin, and we've got to get it done. I'm going there on Sunday, but if we don't do well Sunday, Northwest is going to be booing the home team for sure. I mean, this is code red, as Jay Gruden said a long time ago. So we got to get it done. Happy Thanksgiving.
It's kind of interesting, right? Thanks as always, Joe. It's kind of interesting, and Ben sort of alluded to this, that the fact that we even have a code red game this year, we would have paid for one before the season started, right? You know, code red game with respect to, you know, kind of playoff contention or keeping a season alive. Because, you know, very few predicted that they would be in this race. Look, you know, on one hand, it was a very bad loss. And it was ugly in a lot of ways. And it makes me more concerned about things that I wasn't necessarily concerned about after losses to two really good teams in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and some of the circumstances. I am still very concerned about their ability to stop the run. They have not been a consistent run-stopping team at any point this season. They improved slightly against Pittsburgh and certainly for a half against Philly. Rico Dowdle ran the ball against them, and it made Dallas a two-dimensional team offensively, which they had not been against anybody basically this year. And that was a problem because then they could not generate a pass rush. On offense, they've started punting here in the last three games after basically Tress Way being a guy that they could have kept inactive on some Sundays in the first, you know, half of the season. He had six punts yesterday. And to Joe's point, great field position. Some of that was self-inflicted. You know, some of that was drop passes. Some of that was penalties. And, you know, some of that was just getting beat up front, which happened a bunch yesterday. And maybe they didn't adjust, you know, well enough or effectively enough. But yeah, this one, there are concerns coming out of. And to add to the mix, you're more banged up. You know, you've got two running backs. We don't know if they'll be able to play on Sunday. It's possible that the backs on Sunday are going to be McNichols and Chris Rodriguez. And you may be without your right tackle in Wiley. Which means you got to go with Trent Scott. I didn't think he played that poorly yesterday when he came in. But they were not mauling anybody in the running game. You are going to have to put, you know, what seemed like a bit more of a... I'm not going to say that, you know, beyond Jaden, they were a great supporting cast at any point this year. But there were players that emerged that were truly helpful in addition to Terry. You know, Eckler, Brian Robinson Jr., healthy. You know, Ertz, Noah Brown. Your offensive line was performing at a high level. And now you're kind of banged up and you're looking at that saying... Yeah, we probably needed a second receiver. Yeah, we probably needed more depth along the offensive line. These kinds of things. But again, first year of a recalibration, even though we had to recalibrate in the middle of the recalibration, which, by the way, it's still going on. You're going to get Lattimore at some point here. That'll help. There's been a lot more good to this season than bad. Let's go to Paulie. Paulie, go ahead.
We got hail to the W. Man.
Hail to the W.
Listen, man, I'm hearing a bunch of excuses for the simple fact that this has been the trend going on the past four or five games. That these players are not playing at a high level, period. Like, I can go about coaching. I didn't like some of the things I saw with coaching and philosophy here. But it comes down to the second half of the season, players got to make plays. And not commit dumb penalties and dumb turnovers. And to me, that's where the main blame goes to, is the players. You know, it needs to be a lot of gut checking and staring in the mirror today when it comes to these players. Because regardless of what the philosophy is or the game plan or whatever, they still have to go out and execute. And they haven't been executing at the same level as they was at the beginning of the season. And that's how I see it, man. Now, I'm not even going to talk about the defense. We've had, in the past 4 to 5 games, we've had maximum effort on the defense where they played well enough for us to win games. The offense, on the other hand, is soft, finesse, and predictable. Now, I don't want to hear about Brian Robinson being hurt and we can't run it. They had Rico Suave Dardell out there. Are you telling me he's a prime-time back in this league? No. But they're running the ball with him. They're giving him attempts. Yeah, they're being physical. At what point are we not going to get up underneath the center and run the ball? Right? We have other backs. McNichols always gives us yeoman's work at run back. He came in the other day. He had two nice carries. We ain't seen him no more the rest of the game. You're going with Eckler. Because at his heart, Kingsbury – is the whatever they want to call that running gun or the funny, whatever it is, the offense.
Well, they're not
is,
that.
That's not that, but him and his MO, at heart, that's his MO. And it comes to a point, I said this earlier in the week. Yeah, I know Friday I called up here yelling and screaming, oh, we're going to kick that and all of them because, you know, that's the fan in me. But I said earlier in the week, it's going to be a tough game and they got to go back to fundamentals, which is establishing the running game. And you can't establish the same running game week in, week out, and not have any wrinkles to it. And that's what I see. We're predictable. And
they got whooped up front in the interior, though. But I'm with you. I would have been more patient with the running game. You know I was with you last week. This is a game where you got to – Brian Robinson Jr. goes for 100. You rush for 200 as a team, and you pound them into submission because that's what other teams have done. The quarterback ran effectively. Nobody else did.
Another thing that peed me off about Kingsbury is the one effective drive we had when the game was still the game. You know, the one effective drive when they pimped Michael Parsons all the way down the field for a touchdown, never went back to that. Never went back to it. Clearly,
you're talking about the first drive of the second half?
Right. We never went back to that style of offense.
Anyway, there was a ton of zone read on that drive. Right. Yeah, I know.
And we never.
They ran the football. Eckler for three. Jaden, you know, Eckler for eight on a zone read keeper. You know, Jaden running the ball 5, 13,
right.
Four, and then 17 for the touchdown. I think that Dallas had a real difficult time with the zone read yesterday, and they should have run it even more than they did.
Right, and at that point, you've seen the one player who benefited from that 10 days off was Jaden Daniels. That's the first time in a long time I felt he was 100% healthy, and I think on that
The opponent had something to do with it.
The opponent had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, he had a lot to do with it.
Stop it.
Because they played, Pittsburgh and Philly played him in the zone read, Paulie.
Exactly.
Dallas didn't.
But you still could see.
There's a big difference.
You still could see he wasn't healthy. He was healthy yesterday.
Yeah.
You've seen that. You've seen in the way he was moving around, he was healthy.
Okay, so he was less sore, but he wasn't injured the other two games.
I don't care if he was compromised the other two games.
Okay.
Left sore, whatever you want to say.
It's just that the opponent for you to completely stop doing what you know Joe from Fairfax does. You're a better caller than that. They played two great defenses.
And you're a better show host than that. I don't hear about no great defense. Pittsburgh don't have no great defense. They gave
up really?
Yards to Rico Dowdell too. They can't stop Dowdell neither.
Wait, now we're talking about the other side of the ball. Now we're on our defense.
You say Pittsburgh is a great defense. They are not a great defense.
They're a good team.
Same thing with Baltimore. Is definitely not a great defense.
Agreed with that. I agree with that. Philly's a great defense. If you don't see the difference between Pittsburgh and Philly and Dallas, I can't help you.
It's excuses. I can't help you if you can't see that Jaden Daniels was not healthy in those games. He was healthy in his game.
It's not that he wasn't. It's that the people are blaming him on being injured and don't give any credit to the opponents. That's not an excuse. That's a reality.
I am giving credit to the opponent, but I know what I see, man. And it's an excuse.
Well,
Come on, man.
Since they played a horrible defense yesterday, he was 100% healthy. Ran for 74 yards.
I gotta go.
Stop calling in like you're Joe from Fredericksburg. You're better than that. Yeah. So turns out that old Austin Seibert may have been compromised heading into the game. Maybe that's the injury we should have been talking about all last week. Good morning on this Wednesday, the busiest travel day of the year. Hope you get to where you're going or the people that are coming to see you get to you safely. Happy Thanksgiving right now, so I don't forget. Denton and I will be off tomorrow, and then I'm off on Friday. Denton will be hosting the show on Friday. Am I correct? You're going to host all morning long.
Yeah, I'll be 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Friday morning.
6 a.m. to 10 a.m.
Yeah.
And then nice who's and doing 10 to 1?
So we're simulcast with 106.7. So I believe it's Linnell from 10 to 2.
Linnell from 10 to 2. I will have some smell test picks on the show today for tomorrow's games. And then on Friday, I'll put them out via Twitter. Now I don't feel that badly pitching my smell test picks here after five consecutive winning weekends. Last week, just barely. 7-6. Been killing it in college. But I've got basically every game on the board tomorrow. Give those out a little bit later on in the show. Ben Standing's going to join us at 11. We've got NFL power rankings today, NFL buy and sell. Denton's got 5 NFL burning questions. And I've got a really good what do you got coming up for all of you old school Redskin fans. 50 years ago tomorrow, one of the more significant games in franchise history. But we got to start with Austin Seibert going to injured reserve. By the way, they signed Chris Rodriguez. And of course, we are expecting Zane Gonzalez now to be the kicker. Seibert had been dealing with that hip injury that had cost him a couple of weeks. They brought him back for a game against the Cowboys. We've talked a lot about this week that, you know, the debates about, you know, 2-point conversions and, you know, going for it or not, the debate about the 51-yard field goal with a minute 40 to go on second down, you know, all decent debates that have real good reasons to be on either side of those questions. But to me, the one that was so cut and dried was you don't kick to Kevontae Turpin with 3 minutes to go in a 3-point game, you know, and having 2 timeouts left. You don't want the clock to run on that, and you don't want to put the most dangerous man on the field in play with the ball in his hands. Great kickoff for the landing zone target area, you know, bounced on the turf, went between his legs, but the rest is history after he picked it up. And clearly they didn't have the option of kicking it deep into the end zone to force at least the possibility of a touchback or out of the end zone. Now, we know that all season long, they have had great kick coverage. They have been, you know, targeting the landing zone, trying to get teams stopped before the 30-yard line, bringing a penalty into play. And they've done a great job. But Sunday was not the spot. Sunday was the spot where we needed to turn the clock back a year, where basically 75 to 80% of the kicks in the league went through the end zone for touchbacks or deep enough into the end zone that they were touchbacks. Give them the ball at the 30. But they had a kicker who couldn't do it. The question, of course, is did they know they had a kicker that couldn't do that before the game? Because if they did, why was he active? Zane Gonzalez has a slightly bigger leg, had kicked a couple of touchbacks in the games that he had kicked. They'd given up decent returns in the Pittsburgh game and the Philadelphia game. So the coverage, while it was outstanding for much of the year, they had given up a couple of decent-sized returns in the previous 2 games. And you are now going to be faced with the possibility of the most dangerous returner in the game having the ball being in the game and having the ball in his hands in a game in which you expected to be able to handle offensively and defensively. So why give up anything special teams-wise? He had a 38-yarder on the opening kickoff. He had a 30-yarder on his second kickoff return. On his third kickoff return, he actually should have let the ball go out of bounds or should have caught it with 1 foot out of bounds, 1 foot inbounds, and they would have had it at the 40. Because that ball was headed out of bounds or right near there, and he had an opportunity perhaps to let that ball bounce a little bit and turn it into a much bigger play, but he caught it and went out of bounds. You could say that was an effective kickoff, yes, but there could have been an opportunity for him as well. So did he kick hurt, you know, or did he get hurt during the game? I guess that's something we may find out today when Dan Quinn speaks at 12:30. We will carry that at 12:30. Look, this has been a season in which, so far, 12 games into it, in which there's been, at least from my standpoint, a lot of trust built up into, you know, Dan Quinn in particular. You know, I think by extension, ownership and the general manager, because they picked Dan Quinn, but I have come to feel really good about the hire. I felt good about the hire when they made it. You know, not that if Ben Johnson had been interested in being a head coach, that I wouldn't have been excited about that hire as well, especially in today's game. But I think as the offseason went through, went along and then we got into the season. You know, I think we've got a guy that is high quality. I don't know what we'll learn today. It seems like when it comes to injuries, we don't get direct answers until it's warranted, when we got the clearly and honestly, Jaden Daniels is not injured. Maybe we will get today, Austin Seibert was fully healthy entering that game, and he was banged up during the game, and therefore we didn't have the option of kicking it out of the end zone late with 3 minutes to go. I don't know. It certainly seems like perhaps they brought him back a game too early. And it cost them. Let's not, you know, kid ourselves. They didn't play well enough on offense or defense necessarily to win the game, but they certainly would have won the game with decent special teams play. And that is pretty much a lock. You know, two missed PATs and a missed field goal, and a kickoff that couldn't travel into the end zone and got returned for a touchdown, not to mention a couple of weak onside kick attempts. There you go. It'll be Zane Gonzalez the rest of the year. I also wonder if there's any chance that they got to look at Gonzalez for a couple of weeks and they're like, this guy might be better. Yes, Seibert's 25 of 27, but Gonzalez has a slightly stronger leg. We've got the option of kicking it deeper into the end zone if we want, and maybe they wanted him anyway. I don't know. I think we'll learn something at 12:30. I'd certainly expect those questions, you know, or a question or two to be asked about the kicking situation. With Chris Rodriguez called up, you know, that's certainly an indication that they may be without Brian Robinson Jr. and Austin Ekeler on Sunday. Against a team in Tennessee who is pretty good defensively, you know, when you look at just the traditional statistics, you know, in terms of defense, you're looking at a defense right now in Tennessee that's number two overall in yards allowed. In terms of their pass defense, they are right now number one in the league defensively. In terms of their defensive rank defensively, they're 10th overall per DVOA. This is an excellent defensive football team. Now, at the same time, they give up 26.5 points per game. And the reason for that really is their offense more than it is their defense. Their offense has been a turnover machine. They are second in the league in giveaways with 21. The Raiders lead the league with 22 turnovers. Tennessee is 21. In an overall margin, they are minus 12 in the turnover margin category. You know, they've given up multiple defensive scores, and they've given up some big special teams plays as well. Defensively, they are an outstanding football team. And they're led by, you know, guys like Jeffrey Simmons, who is as good as anybody as an inside, you know, defensive tackle. Harold Landry as a pass rush specialist. Arden Key, Kenneth Murray Jr., Sebastian Joseph Day. This is a good defensive football team. A much better defensive football team on paper than Dallas was. This is more in the category of what they saw against Pittsburgh and Philadelphia defensively. Their problem has been turnovers. They turn the ball over too much. Will Levis has been a turnover machine, although on Sunday he only threw one interception and only fumbled once. But that could be the difference. That's all you need in a game on Sunday, is for Levis to throw, you know, one pick and fumble once. They also had a returner fumble in the Tennessee game. They had three turnovers in the Houston game and still won, which may say a lot about Houston's current state. But they really bottled up Houston from a defensive standpoint. I mentioned this yesterday or the day before. Joe Mixon, off a very successful Monday night game against the Cowboys, where he rushed for 5.5 yards per carry and three touchdowns, 109 yards in their 34-10 win, came back Sunday against Tennessee's defense, 14 carries, 22 yards, 1.6 yards per carry. They, on offense, in their new head coach. I think most of you know this, Brian Callahan. Brian Callahan, the son of Bill Callahan, who is the team's offensive line coach. Randy Jordan, longtime running backs coach here, is now the running backs coach there. They can run the football with Tony Pollard. You know, Bill Callahan could scheme up a run game. Randy Jordan could coach a run game. And Tony Pollard is having a decent season. So they're able to run the football. This is a different opponent. They just lost to a bad team. Tennessee is a bad team because they self-inflict week in and week out with turnovers and mistakes. And it's really about their quarterback, who, by the way, let me just point out, Will Levis, not my favorite, not Denton's favorite, coming out of Kentucky. The dude's got a massive arm, though. There's no doubt about his arm strength. He can make every throw. It's his decision-making, and it's his accuracy that has been the issue. But on Sunday, against Houston's pass rush, you know, he got sacked 8 times in the game, 8. But when he was upright, he was 18 of 24 for 278, 2 touchdowns, including a 63-yarder to Calvin Ridley, a 70-yarder to former Terp tight end Chig Okonkwo, and a 38-yarder to Nick Westbrook-Ikhine, who's been a bit of a reveal here over the last couple of years. So this is not the reason they're 5.5 and a half point favorites over the Titans Sunday versus being an 11-point favorite over the Cowboys is because the odds makers understand Tennessee's a completely different animal than Dallas is. And yet it feels very much like a code red game. It does. You got to get it any way, shape, or form. Got to get this one on Sunday. Not going to be easy. Jeffrey Simmons is a monster. And they've got some really good defensive players. Big test for Washington's offense Sunday at FedEx Field, where I think I mentioned this yesterday. And if I didn't mention it yesterday, the weather on Sunday at FedEx Field is going to be sunny. But Jaden Daniels is about to play in the coldest game he's ever played in his career, at least that we know of. You know, you can only go back and look at Arizona State and LSU games and then understand what he's played with in the pros. Perhaps he's played an all-star game in cold, or perhaps he played a high school game in some cold weather. Sunday's high temperature, even with the sun shining, 37 degrees. Probably close to 34 at kickoff. Welcome to December football in an outdoor stadium on the East Coast or in the Midwest. Dan Quinn will talk today at 12:30 as they begin serious preparation for the Titans on Sunday at 1 o'clock in what will be the coldest game of the year so far, and probably the coldest game that Jaden Daniels has ever played in. Temperatures at kickoff in the mid-30s going up to maybe 39 or 40 degrees during the game. But it will be sunny. By the way, Denton and I just looked it up. Buffalo Sunday night snow game, looks like. 49ers Bills to end Thanksgiving weekend. All right, Ben Standing is with us today. He will be there for Dan Quinn at 12:30. So let's start with the kicker situation. I think, summarized the most likely possibilities, which are he was either not 100% and they brought him up and had him kick Sunday against Dallas, or he was re-injured somehow during the game. A, am I missing any of the other possibilities or likely possibilities? B, what do you think happened?
Well, I'll throw out option C. They decided they were going to move on with him and didn't want to just cut him because then it would be putting the blame squarely on him. But also, like, they put him and keeping him on IR means that, they could still bring him back. Again, he was, 26 of 28 going into this game. He's been one of the big heroes, probably a stretch, but, he's been one of the big keys to this season prior to his injury. So, I think the missing the extra point, we all understand, like, it's not everything's not just down to one play, but wow, that's just such a huge miss. The other element is, Dan Quinn said the other day, he was asked after the game, why didn't he just kick the ball out of, have Cyber kick it out of the end zone? And he responded on the kick to Turpin, when he ran it back 99 yards. And Quinn said, well, you know, it's not as easy to kick it out of the end zone or a touchback as much as you think. So I looked it up, and on Pro Football Reference, it shows that, like, there have been 39 kickers this year with at least 15 kickoff attempts. Of those 39, in terms of touchback percentage, Austin Seibert ranked last, like 23%. He's not, I mean, that's the thing, right? He's pretty consistent typically from, like, 49 in, but get, longer kicks is not his deal. Now, I don't know if they're telling him to kick it short versus not, but, I think both of these things are factors. So that's my guess, that, like, they wanted to keep him, but at the same time, I think they were like, going to be hard to run you back right now after that. That's my best guess. But maybe you've heard. Okay. I don't know.
All right. A couple things that you just mentioned that I want to follow up on. Number one is this.
Sure.
They, have been, and they've led the league, and, we kind of all picked up on this trend 3 or 4 weeks into the season, that they really preferred, we thought it was a preference rather than they didn't have an option, to kick it into the landing zone. And by the way, they were excellent at covering kicks. They've been excellent at covering punts. They've been excellent at covering kicks. He's talked about, some of the team identity being what they've been on special teams with Reeves and Ballore and McNichols, et cetera, getting down and covering kicks. But I'd ask you now, were they doing that because with the guy that they found that could make field goals, 7 for 7, by the way, in his very first game, and they weren't going to turn him loose after that because of all the issues they were having trying to replace Brandon McManus, do you think that that was because they didn't have the option of booting it out of the end zone or booting it deep enough? He does have some touchback kickoffs, but was it just that consistently he wasn't going to be able to do that?
Yeah, maybe it's the consistency part because, like, I looked up, Zane Gonzalez in the limited kicks he's had when he was playing was around similar percentage to Seibert, but for his career, he's a little bit over 50%.
Right.
And 39 kickers that I mentioned, 34 were at least 50% or better. So most of the league is able to, do that half the time, or at least they've chosen to do that. So maybe it is primarily a preference, but yes, it does seem like maybe it's a preference knowing what you're dealing with. Because, I mean, it feels like in this era, like, one of the points of the new kickoff rule was to have more kickoffs because these guys are kicking out of the end zone too often. So,
it was the number one reason for the rule change.
Right. I mean, So I just think that that's, something seems... I mean, look, like you said, it had been working for them. They've largely been pretty good this year, but at the same time, it does feel like it's okay. This is the guy we have. Let's do this then. And I may ask Quinn about this today if I can, depending what the questions are. Well, but I do find it interesting.
Well, here's why it's significant in the moment, because it was so impactful Sunday to the final result. So you mentioned the third option, which is maybe they wanted to move on from him anyway, and this was just essentially a nice way of doing it by putting him on injured reserve, because he was 25 of 27 going into the game. He made his first one, so he was 26 of 28 before he missed a field goal, and then made one, and then missed two PATs. What are we talking about here? Were they just trying to be compassionate?
Well, I don't know. I did the same exercise you were doing, obviously, just trying to figure out what's the deal. I don't know about the injury. I mean, but look, he went on IR, but I don't know that he had something new. Again, maybe Quinn will give us that information today. He obviously had the hip, so I'm sure they could say, hey, it's still bothering him. Look, he just missed extra point, so we're going to do that. But, I don't know. I mean, it just feels like that's a possibility, I think, to some degree. Because, again, to me... That kick to Turpin, I can't say it's more impactful than the missing an extra point, which we just typically view as such a gimme, an afterthought. That's like, oh my, and especially coming in the way that it came. But I do feel like the kickoff was a huge moment as well. Seibert said, "Hey, I should have probably should not have kicked it straight at him." And look, you know, if Jordan McGee stays in his lane or Jeremy Reeves is able to corral him, Turpin when he's coming up, then we're not having a discussion. But that's the way it broke down. So, you know, I am curious. Look again, they may just be like, "Hey, we're good kicking it short and having our players on special teams make the play," but you know, it feels like there's something else there. And then when Quinn says it's not as easy as you think, and yet half the league, 34 of the 39 kickers with at least 15 kicks have half the time gotten a touchback.
Yeah, it's been easy for everybody for a long time.
Right.
But it wasn't easy for him on Sunday because obviously he was hurting. The question is, was he hurting going into the game or did he re-injure during the game? And that's where I think it's just interesting because you were facing the most dangerous returner in the league. And some thought, you know, and I think there's some constructive criticism here that is warranted if they brought him up in lieu of having a bigger legged, healthy kicker facing the number one, you know, threat as a returner in the league. And maybe they just thought, well, I mean, you know, what's he really going to do? We should die. I mean, you don't think that way as a head coach. You got to think through everything. And it's a mistake if he wasn't 100% and didn't have the capability of kicking it deeper to have him activated. But then again, maybe he was healthy and he re-injured himself during the game.
Right. I mean, the part that's also like so, like when everybody is saying, it was so stupid for Quinn. We talked about this the other day, for Quinn to kick the extra point and not go for two because he'd already missed some kicks and blah, blah, blah. He had just made a 51-yard field
exactly.
goal 77
yeah,
seconds
to me, that's
previously.
Not even, yeah.
Right. But I'm just saying, so even to the point of the injury, so he's able to make a 51-yarder 70 seconds of game minutes before and now, you know, so I don't know. You know, who knows? The fact that they have Zane Gonzalez, you know, may have been like, "Hey, look, we already have this other guy, and you know, maybe we just give Seibert a break. We still like him. We're still curious going forward, but you know, we'll see." I don't want to be overly conspiracy theory, but my version of the smell test here doesn't say that it's just because he might be hurt. That seems a little too convenient, but I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. Because heading, like, nobody flinched on him being activated. It was like, great, the guy that's made 25 out of 27 is back. Look, the only thing to me that wasn't debatable, the two-point conversion, totally debatable. Kicking the 51-yarder on second down is debatable. But you don't kick to Turpin in that spot. Like, that's not debatable. However, the answer is they didn't have a choice because the guy they had kicking off wasn't capable of giving them a start at the 30-yard line with a touchback. All right, what about Brian Robinson Jr. and Austin Ekeler? What do you think we're going to learn about them today?
Well, so they worked out a couple of running backs yesterday, but my understanding is they're not signing any of them. And there were a couple of guys who, you know, been in the, you know, Boston Scott has been with the Eagles, James Robinson, who was the Jags leading rusher a couple of years ago. So guys who, you know, have some ability, but my understanding is they're not signing any of them. I think they may be signing a defensive back, but I don't know for sure. So that says to me, if in fact they are not bringing in anybody else, that Brian Robinson has a chance to play. That's just a guess, but like, you know, again, yes, I know they re-signed Chris Rodriguez, but even with Chris Rodriguez and McNichol, that's only two, and that's, you know, you would think you'd want, you know, I guess they can elevate Michael Wiley from the practice squad, but, you know, I'm not counting that as like a real thing. So my guess would be Robinson at least has some chance to play, but we'll just have to see how the weekend goes. Ekeler, obviously, you know, it's not just this concussion, it's his second one of the season, and, you know, he looked pretty out of it when he got up off the field the other day. When he had the concussion earlier in the year against the Bengals, he didn't play the next week. So just based on that and you know, again, the second one this year, I would guess he doesn't play, especially with the bye week coming up. My real question for the Ekeler thing is, when does he play again? Or if he plays again? I don't know. I don't want to go overboard and speculate, but just, you know, that looked like a pretty scary situation, and You know, that's obviously going to be a thing for them to discuss. So I seems hopeful that Robinson can go, but again, I have no idea until they get out there and practice, and we'll see that in a little bit.
Yeah, losing Eckler for any significant amount of time is actually a big miss, and you know they've been without both of them at various times this year, and when they've had both of them healthy, they've been pretty damn good as a running football team. Is Brian Robinson Jr.'s ankle injury a high ankle sprain or not? Typically, high ankle sprains are much worse. Do you have any idea?
I mean, that hasn't been said. Okay. So, you know, I would imagine if it was something more significant like that, it would have been out there by now. But no, we haven't heard that. But again, a good question for Dan Quinn today. And by the way, just to say, like, as a sort of a separate note for me, you know, the Jeremy McNichols has been effective, obviously, for them this year when he's played. I mean, he's been one of the bigger, frankly, surprises when he had some bigger games earlier in the year, bigger roles. But I had a, you know, when we did the initial 53, I kind of refused to put him on it, partly because, one, I thought he could clear waivers, you know, because of, you know, he hadn't done anything really the previous 2 years. But secondly, I don't know what he is. In a situation now where hypothetically both Robinson and Eckler are out, he doesn't really replace either of them. He's not exactly this dynamic pass catcher, nor is he a guy you're going to run between the tackles. And for the third guy, for me, and I know you got to factor in special teams and things like that, can he do one of these things that you want them, what your running backs to do? I think Chris Rodriguez has a chance to, again, I'm not saying he's good as Robinson, but has a chance to replicate some of that tough running. And, you know, again, you can't solve all your problems. You can't fix all your depth. And McNichols has been a very fine player for them. No knocking that. He's done fine. But that's why, for me, like, I look for that third running back. Can you do something specific? And I don't know what he does. And that's why, like, I don't know what the running game looks like if he's in there, because he's not really beating you with strength. He's not really beating you with speed. So what's he doing? That's kind of why I view that third running back spot.
Yeah, I think it's opponent dependent. I think I bet if we went back and looked at his biggest runs on the season, they were zone read runs. They were, mm-hmm. you know, options for Jaden to either keep it or give it. Look, some of Brian Robinson Jr.'s and Eckler's biggest runs this year were read option plays, but it depends on the opponent. Tennessee is really tough in the interior. Jeffrey Simmons is a monster. They're a 3-4 base, you know, so there is the, you know, that's a team that's tough to run on, period. Tough to throw on, period. But you got to get it going somehow, because they're better when they're running the football, I think, for sure. Ben Standing is joining us right now. Do you think we'll hear today about Lattimore's availability?
I just want to say, by the way, if you're a listener just tuning in, I thought Kevin gave an excellent breakdown of the Tennessee team in the opening segment. Go back and listen if you missed it. I enjoyed listening to that.
Are you being sarcastic?
Absolutely not. You did a great job of breaking down why the spread is half of what it was against Dallas, because Tennessee's actually got a lot of good stuff. They just have too many turnovers, and even that, with Levis is playing better. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, I obviously will get some sense of Lattimore, right? He'll be, you know, there'll be an injury report today and all that. You know, if he's not practicing today, like full practice, I don't know. It seems to me he's not playing this week. When you have the bye week coming up, you know, if he's not able to go right off the bat, then it says, okay, he's probably not really ready. So if that's the case, then, you know, wait another week, get to the bye, and go from there. You know, I think that, you know, what's there to say? He obviously, you know, I'm sure everybody wants him to be out on the field, himself included, but it hasn't happened yet. So, I've gotten people texting me, tweeting at me, why would Washington make a trade for a guy who was hurt? And what I can, best I can say is that the reason Adam Peters made this trade, it was not for this year. I mean, it was to help this year, but it was for the long haul. That this is a guy who's still in the prime of his career, a Pro Bowl level player, who's under contract for two more years, meaning not only at a position, mind you, where other than Mikey Sanders, still Washington doesn't have anybody under contract who, you know, is going to play. I'm not counting Emmanuel Forbes at this point. So it checks off a box for next year. They don't have to bid at like three or four different positions. They do one, and then obviously he would play this year. So if somehow he's not able to come back this week or whatever, there's still logic for making the deal. But obviously, you know, there's a reason they made it now, and they want him to be out there to help cover guys like, say, Calvin Ridley on the Titans. And then others going forward.
Well, look, the other part of it is that, you know, they caught the Saints in a moment. You know, they had just lost to the Panthers. They decided they were in sell mode. They've actually played much better since the trade. They wouldn't have had him for those games either. But, you know, ironically, the Saints are not out of this thing. They're sitting there at 4-7. They play Washington, you know, coming out of Washington's bye week. But they got a home game against the Rams and a game against the Giants to get to 6-7, which would put them right back in the mix. But Washington caught him at the right time. It was the right time to make that move. Whether he was really available before the trade deadline or not, the timing of it was great. And of course, there's an element to, we're 7-2, we're a contender, and we need a corner for this run. But to your point, he had 2 years left on his deal, so it wasn't, you know, they weren't going to ever do a rental in this first year. We're talking to Ben Standing. By the way, I did not ask you about Andrew Wiley, who I guess I didn't realize until earlier this week that when he left the game, it was with a concussion. So he's in concussion protocol as well. And that, you know, they're facing a tough front. That could be, you know, they could use him Sunday. So I guess we'll find out more about him. By the way, a friend of mine texted me and said that Brian Robinson was on with the Junkies yesterday. So Brian Robinson was on with the Junkies yesterday and said it's not a high ankle sprain and he already feels much better. So that may be the reason that you believe they're not going to sign, you know, other backs, is that they're going to have number 8 ready,
yeah,
hopefully.
That was at least some indication I got that they were going to not add anybody because they felt that he had a shot to play. You know, what that shot meant was my question. But yeah, that's good. Good to know that it's not a high ankle sprain.
So, is this a code red game?
I think so. I mean, it is insane, right? The 3-8 team at home. You wouldn't think this would be too complicated, but look, they're 7-5. They're right now. Well, I guess it's two ways. If we're just talking about the playoffs, right? Put aside, they're building in the right direction and all that stuff. 7-5, they're only a half a game up on on Arizona. And I know they have the tiebreaker head-to-head, yeah, but Arizona could still win the division, so that I'm not worrying about that. But, yeah, they're half a game up on Arizona right now. If they lose this game, you're going to a bye miserable, so I don't know how relaxing it'll be for everybody, certainly probably not for the coaching staff. And then look what's coming up. I mean, the Saints, like you said, are playing better, and it's in New Orleans. You've got the Eagles, who, you know, obviously are one of the best teams in the league. Atlanta, you know, when Kirk Cousins in that passing game is going, they've been very hard to beat this year. And then Dallas, look, week 18, we can say all the things we want. They just beat Washington. So, I think they got to win this game. Because I think when you look at a bigger picture, you know, I think getting to 10 wins, putting aside that would be a big accomplishment to get to double-digit wins, 10 wins would probably mean you're in the playoffs, right? 9 wins might, but now you're letting the NFC West teams have a little more of a chance. Again, it may only be Seattle and Arizona at this point, and they would have to, you know, still get 3 wins each to get to 9. But if you lose to Tennessee, now you have to win 2 of your last 4 to get to 9, and, you know, it's becoming harder to see where that's happening. 2 of the games are on the road. The 2 tougher opponents are at home, so that's somewhat helpful, I guess. But yeah, no, I think this is, you bet. I think if we're talking playoffs, I think you got to win this game, or it is going to be very tense. Maybe not for them, but in the discussion about where this team is at, for sure.
I think you're right. I mean, look, all the macro stuff, you know, if they end up with 8 wins, 9 wins, don't go to the playoffs. We've learned that they got the quarterback right. We've learned that the head coach is pretty good. But, you know, ultimately they just didn't have the right supporting cast. They had some, you know, injuries at the wrong time. They played in a crazy, crazy game with special teams plays all over that we'll almost never forget on Sunday. And the big picture, I mean, it'd be hard for the big picture to be tainted at this point. I guess it could be if they lost, you know, four out of their final five and it really, really regressed in terms of the quarterback. But I think that the big picture's solidified. But you don't, you know, as fans, you don't think that way in, you know, late November, December. You expected a couple of weeks. The expectations have gone from, let's just find out about the quarterback, to, whoa, we might have a chance for the playoffs, to, oh my God, this could be an 11-plus win season. We could be a contender, to now back to, we've dialed back the expectations to, they're hanging on for dear life. Hopefully they'll just make the playoffs and have a meaningful game. Which, by the way, let me just mention, because I've mentioned this before over the years when they've had these chances. And even in 2020, when people are saying, no, don't make the playoffs as a 7-9 team because you're going to, you know, ruin your draft position. I think playing meaningful games for the young players on this team down the stretch, and then playing potentially in a playoff game at Lambeau, let's just say, or not at Lambeau, but maybe at you know, in Atlanta or Tampa or Seattle in the first round, or Philadelphia, that's huge, invaluable experience that does carry over. You know, even when the roster changes significantly, especially for a young quarterback to play in those games, I want to see that. I don't want to see that get squandered away. And if you lose Sunday, that possibility now exists that you're playing not meaningful games the final two or so, and not in the postseason. So I don't want to, at this point, throw away that kind of an experience that is still very much a possibility.
Well, as somebody who was leading the bandwagon for don't make the playoffs in 2020 because of all those reasons.
Yeah.
It's massively different now. The reason then was, you know, again, we see how the players turned out, but you had a chance to draft a Justin Fields or a Mac Jones or whatever, some young quarterback. That part doesn't matter now. And while we always talk about, you know, no matter what the position is, obviously you're better off picking as high as you can because therefore, in theory, you're getting the pick of the litter. You know, you can get all kinds of players. You know, there's, you know, as we know, there's 22 starters on the field, offense, defense, which means that there's lots of guys, lots of positions who are going to get, guys who are going to start, who are going to get picked in the first round and even in the second round. So it doesn't matter now. Making the playoffs, having that experience for the quarterback, I agree, would be very beneficial, and there should be zero discussion of, well, they're better off losing. That makes no sense anymore. That's out as long as you believe Jaden Daniels is the guy, which obviously everybody does. So, that part's not relevant. But, yeah, you hope, obviously, that at this point that they go forward just because it would be a positive experience, not just to have the experience of playing in the game, the playoff game, but actually not stubbing your foot so badly you don't even make the playoffs at this point. Because, you know, the human beings in the locker room, they don't care about anything we're talking about. They want
to, of course not.
They're tasting this, they see it, and to be so close to them to not get it would be, you know, obviously pretty painful.
I think the difference in 2020 was Jamin Davis at, was it 19? And I think 12 was a possibility.
I think they would have been picking like 10 or 11 based on, I think, where the Giants.
I thought it was 12, but you might be right.
And like, you know, even if you don't take Justin Fields, Micah Parsons was sitting there. If they
the
were
Giants
really that bad,
would have helped. Drafted, the Giants would have drafted at 11, and that's who would have made the won the division. So Washington would have been at 11. Remember, they're the ones that traded with Chicago to
right. Okay.
To give them the chance to draft Justin Fields. I just remember thinking Chase Young's dominant. I mean, you know, in the moment, he's having a rookie of the year, dominant rookie of the year season. Sweats great, Allen and Payne. This is gonna be great for them. Who did we miss out on? We missed out on Micah Parsons. That's who we missed out on.
Micah Parsons, Devonta Smith was picked right around
before.
There.
Yeah, the pick before, yeah.
J.C. Horn was right around there.
They were all picked before 11.
All before? Okay, well, yeah. But I'm forgetting who was there. But, yeah, I mean, some of these guys were still sitting there.
All right, I'll talk to you later in the week. I appreciate it as always.
Yeah, man. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. And,
happy Thanksgiving
good luck
to you, too. You've been great. It's always fun to have you on, and I hope you have a great Thanksgiving.
Likewise. See ya.